The headlines: Brazil breaks its record for new daily deaths from the novel coronavirus. That to come later on. Of course, the top Iranian security sources rule out the country's step-for-step return to the JCPOA. Brazil breaks its record for new daily deaths from the novel coronavirus with nearly 2,000 fatalities. And also in our headlines, nearly 40 migrants die when their boats sink off Tunisia as they try to cross the Mediterranean to the Italian island of Lampedusa. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: a top Iranian security official has ruled out any step-for-step return to the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The official said Iran will fully resume its JCPOA obligations only after the U.S. removes its sanctions. He said the new U.S. administration has failed to lift the sanctions and added Tehran will further reduce its commitments if Washington retains them. The Iranian official also dismissed any official or unofficial talks with the U.S. before the sanctions are lifted. He said Iran's defense and missile programs, as well as its regional presence, have nothing to do with the nuclear deal. Earlier on Wednesday, President Hassan Rouhani urged the U.S. to end its inaction regarding the accord.
We hope those who have violated the rules and now say they want to adhere to them show this by their actions and end the economic terrorism against Iran and stop their violations.
Rouhani said the time is ripe for the full implementation of the JCPOA if other signatories fulfill their commitments too. He reiterated that Iran will fully live up to its obligations once other parties do so. However, he said Iran's measures will be proportional. The U.S. walked out of the nuclear deal in 2018 and reinstated tough sanctions on Iran under former President Donald Trump. The new U.S. administration has signaled its readiness to re-enter the agreement, but wants Iran first to return to full compliance. Well, for more on that story, we're now joined by author and commentator John Stepling, joining us from Android. Mr. Stepling, welcome to the program. Give us your thoughts on Iran's stance.
Well, I think Iran is probably justified in taking a pretty hard line stance here. There's no indication so far in Biden's administration that his foreign policy will deviate from the previous six presidents or seven presidents and their foreign policy. Foreign policy doesn't change in the United States. Biden's appointments, William Burns is now going to head the CIA. He's considered kind of a moderate. If anything, he's a Russophobe and not a Islamophobe. Anthony Blinken is Secretary of State. We see a former Raytheon executive as Secretary of Defense and a high-ranking military officer, a general. These people are all kind of moderate hawks, but behind the scenes, all the advisors and people like Jake Sullivan and so forth are extremist hawks and Victoria Nuland. And we've already seen U.S. troops moved into Syria and bombing there. I don't think that Biden's administration is opposed to, returning to the JCPOA, but all of this is happening against a backdrop of massive unemployment, homelessness. All the lockdown has gone on for a year. This pandemic has destroyed economies, destroyed American retail. It's been a monopolization of retail in the U.S. It has crippled economies in Europe as well. And we're also seeing massive protests against these lockdowns. So there's extreme economic uncertainty going on. And frankly, for the U.S. And the Biden team, who are always concerned with perception, like all politicians, this is not a front burner issue. It's just not. And I think they also have made clear, though, Anthony Blinken said the other day, they reiterated the same old line: Iran must not have a nuclear weapon. And that, of course, begs the question every time: well, why does Israel get to have nuclear weapons and remain signatory to no international agreement? It's always the great unasked question. Well, of course, you see problems in Israel as well. There's political upheaval, Netanyahu's trial, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of turmoil going on. I think this is just going to, they're just going to kick the can down the road again for a while, while other things resolve themselves or you know, further don't resolve themselves, and before returning to this. I just don't think they're going to take decisive action right now. Biden just agreed with Congress on a something like a $400 billion improvement to the nuclear weapons program. That's like $50 billion a year for a decade, and it goes into the trillions if we take it beyond that. And there's been a lot of controversy about this. There's $500 trillion or some unimaginable amount is going to defense over the next few years. So the U.S. isn't changing course at all. It's just that Trump was a bit of an outlier because he was so ill-informed and ignorant on a personal level, and his appointees were so boorish and extremist and xenophobic that it makes Biden seem calm and statesmanlike, and he's not. You know, he's very conservative and very hawkish, and that's what we can expect. I just don't think there will be decisive action in the immediate future.
All right, thanks a lot, author and commentator John Stepling, joining us from Indoor. Elsewhere, Brazil has once again broken its record for new daily coronavirus deaths with nearly 2,000 fatalities. Brazil's COVID death toll is now above 268,000. It's the world's second worst country in terms of fatalities after the U.S. Brazil also has the third largest infection tally in the world with more than 11.1 million cases. The situation is dire there, with hospitals being overwhelmed and a vaccination program going slowly. Despite that, President Jair Bolsonaro has renewed his criticism of quarantine measures. Brazil is followed by Mexico in terms of total virus fatalities. Mexico's death toll is nearing 192,000 out of more than 2 million cases. A newly conducted poll in the U.S. shows about 4 in 10 Americans are still grappling with the financial impact of the coronavirus pandemic. The survey conducted by the Associated Press suggests 1 in 4 U.S. citizens have experienced household layoffs during the pandemic. It also shows COVID-19 has affected poorer communities and people of color more adversely. The outbreak has also impacted service, entertainment, and travel sectors worse than the others. The United States is the worst hit country in the world by the coronavirus. It has recorded more than 29 million infection cases and over 527,000 fatalities. Economics professor David Barkin believes a bill by the new U.S. administration to address the unequal impact of the COVID crisis on American society would hardly prove beneficial.
The figures you talked about in terms of layoffs, the terms of the discrimination against people of color, Latins, other minority groups, only begins to touch the surface of the depths of the inequality of the, I'm sorry, the unequal impact of the virus, the pandemic, on the American people. What's the most extraordinary thing about it is the hope that the way in which the new legislation that Biden has now pushed, I think almost pushed through the Congress, will try to reverse this dynamic. And I'm not sure of that, because the impetus of the new program is to depend upon the market through greater spending. But I think that the real problem is that there are structural issues that are involved.
Britain summons the European Union's UK representative amid a deepening row over COVID-19 vaccine exports. This comes after European Council President Charles Michel claimed Britain and the US have imposed a ban on the export of vaccines produced in their territory. In a letter to Michel, UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab argued that any references to a UK export ban or any restrictions on vaccines are completely false. The EU is criticized for a slow vaccine rollout and not doing enough to supply jabs to poor countries, but the bloc defended its overall strategy, saying without Europe, it would not have been possible to develop several vaccines in less than a year. The chances of survival for those suffering severe illness due to COVID-19 differs greatly across the European Union. EU lawmakers say the pandemic has highlighted deadly health inequalities within the bloc. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
How the EU deals with crises was the subject of scathing criticism during a debate on the bloc's health systems in the European Parliament. There were major failings when COVID-19 began to wreak havoc in Italy 13 months ago, and now the EU's vaccine strategy is being described as a fiasco.
Ci sta chiedendo perché.
Citizens are wondering why we are not rolling out the Chinese, Russian or Cuban vaccines. Perhaps it's because the European Union has decided to give more importance to relations with the US instead of saving thousands of people.
The death toll from COVID-19 in the 27-country EU is approaching 550,000.
The pandemic exposed the vulnerability of our healthcare systems as we experienced care disruptions, medical shortages, health system inadequacy, insufficient and unequal access to healthcare.
Instead of improving during the course of the pandemic, apparently the situation is getting worse.
Some of these inequalities are widening, not only across countries, but also across population groups within each country.
One clear example of inequality was highlighted during the debate. Statistics show a person in intensive care with COVID-19 in Luxembourg has a 65% chance of survival. In fellow EU nation Romania, it's just 25%.
Some legislators say the EU's poor handling of successive crises has dangerous political consequences, and experts agree.
We're seeing the rise of the far right across Europe, and this is not just far right, not right, just right-wing populism. This is naked racism. This is neo-fascism.
The EU Commissioner for Health, Stella Kariakides, has told lawmakers that lessons have been learned the hard way due to the coronavirus.
Indeed, we're determined to respond in a way that looks to the future and develops concrete benefits and protection to the citizens.
Legislators have just passed a €5.1 billion budget for a programme called EU for Health. However, they are well aware that reforms don't happen overnight when it comes to the EU project. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
New research shows cotton masks that become moist through breath are better at halting the spread of the coronavirus. The research was conducted by the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology. It shows humidity from human breath makes cotton masks 35% more effective at capturing particles than when they're dry. When particles pass through a moistened cotton mask, they absorb some of the moisture inside and grow larger. That makes the particles more likely to get trapped in the mask. That's why the study shows synthetic fabrics showed no performance change in stopping particles when humid. Tunisia says nearly 40 migrants have drowned off its southeastern coast after two boats heading for Europe capsized. The Tunisian Defense Ministry says more than a dozen women and children were among the dead. It says Tunisian Coast Guard has rescued over 160 migrants before temporarily suspending the operation due to bad weather. The ministry says the boats were trying to cross over the Mediterranean to an island in southern Italy. Tunisia's southeastern coastline has turned into a major departure point for those feeling conflict and poverty in Africa and the Middle East. Tunisia says it has intercepted nearly 100 migrant boats since the start of the year. Hundreds of health facilities across Yemen are on the brink of collapse due to the Saudi blockade and lack of fuel. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion has warned that it can no longer store blood stocks. Our correspondent in Sana'a, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, has more.
Thousands of cancer patients in Yemen are in dire need of help. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion and Research says the blood stocks and components of concentrated red cells, fresh frozen plasma, and the platelets cannot be reserved anymore due to the lack of fuel.
We have entered the dangerous stage of the collapse of health centers across the country. Our branches in Hodeida and LBB have stopped their operations, and the rest of the branches are about to stop. There is no justification for this blockade. The interruptions in the import of fuel mean the death of patients with kidney failure and chronic diseases.
The center provides services to hundreds of kidney failure patients and cancer patients, including children with leukemia, who depend on the center to obtain the necessary substances to survive.
This center provides more than 60% of its services to people with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and wounded people. The fuel crisis is making an already bad situation worse amid the war and siege. Patients with kidney failure and leukemia need regular checks and doses of medicines, and stopping these services leads to the death of patients.
Yemenis are suffering from fuel shortage due to the continued detention of 14 petrol ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The fuel crisis is threatening the closure of over 1,500 health facilities around the country.
International aid organizations and watchdogs have warned that the lives of millions of people in Yemen are in danger due to the all-out blockade imposed on the country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The international community has so far failed to take action and stop Riyadh from committing war crimes. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
South Korea says it has agreed to increase its funding for U.S. military troops stationed in the country by nearly 14%. Under a new deal, South Korea will pay more than $1 billion for hosting some 28,500 U.S. service members this year. That's the biggest annual rise in nearly two decades. South Korea's foreign ministry says the increase in the contribution reaffirms the need for a stable deployment of U.S. forces in the country. The rise in part of a six-year, is rather part of a six-year pact that replaces an expired deal. Seoul has been paying Washington for its troop presence since early 1990s. The soldiers are meant to defend South Korea against possible threats from its nuclear-armed neighbor, North Korea. New anti-coup protests have been held in Myanmar despite a military crackdown that the UN says has left at least 50 people dead. Security forces fire tear gas to disperse protesters in some locations. No casualties have been reported. Anti-coup protests have been ongoing in Myanmar since the army seized power early this month. The protesters want civilian rule. They also want the release of their detained civilian officials, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. The junta has unleashed a crackdown in response. On Wednesday, it raided the home of a pro-democracy member and detained him in a northern town in the largest city, Yangon. Police swooped on a railway station to arrest workers on strike against the coup. Well, the Armenian government says the dismissal of Chief of General Staff Onyek Gasparyan has come into force. The government said the dismissal is legally effective as the president had not signed the decree within the given time frame. It said the president has not gone to court under specific articles of the law either. Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan dismissed Gasparyan last month after the army detained the premier, rather demanded the premier to step down. President Armen Sarkisyan refused to give his final approval to the dismissal twice. He said the move was unconstitutional. The president's office now says he has appealed to the Constitutional Court to review the legality of the sacking. The premier has faced calls to resign over a November ceasefire deal with Azerbaijan. The U.S. state of Hawaii has declared a state of emergency after heavy rains caused damaging floods on several of its islands. Heavy rains have inundated parts of Hawaii for the past several days. The U.S. Weather Service reported at least 33 centimeters of rainfall in just 8 hours. Heavy flooding has also forced evacuations in some locations over fears of dam failures. On the island of Maui, a dam has already overflowed and destroyed homes. No casualties, however, were caused. Heavy rains are expected to last through Friday. And that's a wrap for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. We have been discussing about the qualities of the pious people based on the sermon of the pious in Nahjul Balagha. And of course, Imam Ali alayhi salam has taught us very many lessons and encouraged us to take a heed of this and like apply them in our lives so that we can also slowly achieve the levels of piety. And we, of course, reach this section where Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about gluttony, or rather he talks about controlling food intake, where he says that a pious person is one who, mazuran akluhu, whose eating is less, is controlled. And Imam Ali alayhi salam here, of course, is a very small sentence, rather it's just two words, mazuran akluhu, that means controlled and less eating, but it has a vast depth inside it. Of course, the Sharia has given us various ways in controlling the food intake that I mentioned previously. And we started to discuss about a few of those methods that can help a person to control his food intake. Previously, we started to discuss the fact that a person, when he eats food, it's important that he should not eat in ready-made packs of food, because those ready-made packs are made for, let's say, specific amount, specific types of people. And therefore, when a person eats that whole pack, it's not for him. Like, everyone is custom-made. Everyone's stomach is custom-made. I mean, they should, in fact, choose how much to eat, remove that food from its pack and keep it in their own plate and then eat what is required. That would be one nice method of controlling food intake.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Another method of controlling food intake is the issue of not having too many distractions while eating. So, for example, some people like to eat food while watching television, right? Or, you know, yeah, mostly it's television, or maybe they are playing a video game. And when someone is distracted, they just keep on filling their plates, you know, one by one. So they could be eating a lot of food. Maybe some people eat less while they are distracted, but other people, they might eat more. For example, if there is music, right? They would be listening to the music and keeping on eating and eating and eating. And now, these distractions have to be reduced. Instead, a person, when he eats with his family, I mean, and, you know, in the family culture should be such that everyone eats, you know, in a good way, following the recommended acts of Islam. All of this creates a wonderful effect. You know, if a family has this culture of having the Islamic way of life while eating food, everyone sits, everyone says Bismillah, everyone, you know, eats, choose their food, you know, everyone, for example, at the end of the food says Alhamdulillah, they start with salt, they end with salt. All of these things, you know, they kind of create that environment whereby a person controls their food intake. Or a person just enters the food, you know, just keeps on eating and with all those distractions around him, that would be a bit of a harmful. Another way to control food intake and control gluttony is that a person should try to reduce stressful situations. People in stress, they end up eating a lot because of the fact that there are certain hormones released when a person eats food that are kind of that help in creating some level of happiness in the mind and kind of a relief from that stress. A person can reduce that stress by doing many things. I mean, that is another discussion separately. They can reduce that stress before, coming for their meals or having a discussion with someone about it and kind of have a regime, having a setup whereby they have control over the stress in their lives. If it's a very serious situation, then they might need to visit the psychiatrist to control their stress. If it is not so serious, then they can use other methodologies to control their stress slowly, and then it will help them to control their food intake.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Another helpful way is when a person eats food is that they should try eating foods with a lot of fiber. Foods that have fiber but less fat and fatty, because fatty foods and carbohydrate food actually is the type of food that creates that feeling of happiness, kind of. Certain hormones are released because of that and makes a person happy. So when a person eats fatty food, can continuously eat that food, because of course carbohydrates are needed by the body, they create energy. That's kind of a natural mechanism that is there in the system. But instead, if you eat fiber stuff, your stomach will get filled quickly, the feeling to eat more will be reduced. So for example, a person can have a bowl of salad before eating, right? Before eating their dinner or their lunch. You know, I've cooked something for lunch, but I'll have a small bowl of salad and like properly eat that. You see that your stomach is a bit filled by this time, you know, something like kidney beans, okay, foods like that. For example, grapefruit, these type of fruits that have fibers would kind of help that person, fill the stomach a bit. And then the amount of food that person would eat that is filled with, let's say, carbohydrates and that would also reduce. This kind of will help control that urge to eat a lot, you know, during that meal. And of course, generally eating fibrous fruits, even fibrous foods, eating, for example, oatmeal, all of these types of foods are kind of good in helping controlling the state of overeating. And of course, If a person has a timetable, has a proper timetable in eating food, and has organized his day in a way that he eats foods at specific times, this would be also helpful. Inshallah, in the next session, we'll try to discuss a little bit about this. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
Inside Israel. Subhuman conditions in Israel for foreign workers and migrants. That's according to a report by Israel's Hotline for Refugees and Migrants NGO. It describes treatment by Israeli authorities of detained migrants akin to torture. Migrants, according to the NGO, are being hit with belts, have lack of contact with the outside world, and receive just moments of free time in the open air in Israel.
14 months you've been in the detention facility in the south of Israel. And 14 months, you make connections, like you said. You are living all day for 14 months with people. And one day, they are seeing you getting out of there. How do they feel about this?
I mean, it is really very sad that being incarcerated there for 14 months. There are a lot of people also for more than that. And there is no any justification at all. They release me without... telling me why, and I'm sure that they gain nothing of incarcerating somebody like me or others who are in Holocaust right now. There is no gain out of it at all, other than torturing some other human beings.
In one location alone, there are 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women. They are living in subhuman conditions that fail to meet legal standards. A new report by an Israeli human rights group paints a picture of humiliating treatment towards foreign workers and migrants. It shows the extent of unlawful arrest and actual physical violence that they face. The report by the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants for 2019 gathered dozens of testimonies. It revealed shocking incidents at several migrant detention facilities where migrants are detained. The report states that dozens of detainees were imprisoned for months in several detention facilities all across Israel. In fact, according to the report, authorities in these facilities used extreme methods to control the detainees. These methods include beatings with a belt and the forced use of sleeping pills. One such facility is the Yahalom Detention Center. It is located at Ben Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv, the capital. In 2019, it held approximately 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women in subhuman conditions that failed to meet legal standards. Many of the tortured migrants come from Africa and Southeast Asia. Israel's Ynet News cites care worker from the Philippines who worked in Israel for 15 years as saying, "The three of us were locked in a small room without a TV and without our phones that were confiscated." The report also found that immigration inspectors are now breaking into places of residence by force. Additionally, the report claims that in 2019, there was a sharp increase in the number of deported families. It claims that the actual total number of deportees amounted to 6,694. The data and evidence reveal conduct that violates the High Court's directive and even the immigration authorities' own procedures, according to Sigal Rosen from the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants.
Main trends we identified were detention of those who denied entry to Israel, preventing those who have been denied entry from applying for asylum when they wanted to. There was, again, cases of violence by immigration authority inspectors towards detainees. In the last year, there was a special problem of detention of families with children, school children, ahead of their deportation from Israel. During the last year, the Immigration Authority started focusing on efforts to detain school-age children. This population was previously spared from detention and deportation, but in the last year, the immigration started arresting these children, especially in order to deport them. Unfortunately, the Israeli immigration policy is to allow the immigration of Jews only, and whoever is not Jewish and is not entering to Israel under the law of return, but under the entry to Israel law, the Israeli government is doing whatever in its power to arrest and deport him. Well, if Israel doesn't want non-Jews to live in this country, then they just don't need to bring these people. Right now, and actually anytime, there is more than 100,000 legal migrant workers that the government is initiating their entry into the country. It is not reasonable to invite all these people and then to deport them. And this is already amount to torture. Detaining a migrant who committed no crime just because Israel failed to deport him for such long years without any prospect for release is definitely a torture.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Traf Lab says COVID-19 made the situation of some of the most vulnerable workers worse and introduced some highly restrictive targeted policies that had grave impact on their lives. Hopefully, it also created an opportunity to rethink policies and reassess how to address vulnerabilities. Brin says Israel's crimes include ethnic cleansing, bouts of genocide in Gaza, torture of children, theft of land, targeted killings and murder, house demolitions, and myriads more since the squatter entity was unilaterally declared in Palestine by a Polish immigrant in May 1948.
The facts are that Israel signed the UN Convention on Refugees, which means that they're supposed to give refugees and according to international law, regardless of the convention, but they're supposed to give refugees safe haven if they're leaving from a country where they're in trouble, where they're in danger. And obviously that's not what's really happening on the ground. They face a lot of racism, they face a lot of legal and bureaucratic issues. So on the one hand, on paper, Israel is supposed to be treating them in a different way than what's happening on the ground. Of course, I mean, in any country, when an immigrant or an asylum seeker comes for work or to flee danger, they're obviously at a disadvantage, right? Because of language, because of legal issues, because of all kinds of things, and so it's easy to exploit them. Here, we have a particularly difficult situation because, as I explained, most of the asylum seekers are not getting legal and social help from the government. And so, you know, they need to somehow be able to raise their families, to feed their kids. So if they're, you know, working under the table or working at restaurants and being taken advantage of, the system is sort of set up to do that rather than to help.
Okay, so yes, in general, I think there's a fundamental racist problem in Israel. It has always been an issue in Israel. The targets of the racism have changed. It was either, at the beginning, I would say, the Arab population or the Sephardic population, what we call the people that came from north of Africa and Yemen. They suffer from systematic racism towards, even from the beginning. And of course, now that we have the Ethiopian Jews that came to Israel 20, 30, 40 years ago, and of course, the asylum seekers coming from Africa, they all suffer from a systematic racist problem in Israel. It's quite unbelievable, even. It's heartbreaking. And you can see the results. Actually, the Ethiopian Jews, I was in the trial yesterday of Salomon Tukak, a young Jewish Ethiopian boy that was murdered by the police. Then he was shot by a police officer. We have succeeded to raise awareness, and there's a trial going on, which is quite exceptional. But we know that the trial will not bring anything, and the policeman is not blamed of murdering the boy. He's blamed of, I don't know, some sort of something else. But in general, we have a long list of young Ethiopian boys that are being imprisoned, criminalized, killed. So of course, when it comes to even the Jewish black community, the asylum seekers suffer from it much more. I think basically it stems from the fact that the Jewish community that established, the Zionists that has established Israel, came from Western Europe. East European countries. I think they all suffer from racism until today. So basically, I think we brought the racism from Europe to Israel, when you think about the people that established Israel, including my great-grandparents and my family from both sides. So I think they came with the notion that anything that is not European is not equal to them. And of course, I think it had to do with the fact that we had to basically, we're committing ethnic cleansing towards the Arab population in that was here in Palestine. So in order to do that, you have to make them subhuman. And I think that, you know, echoes the way we treated the community, the Jewish community that came, as I said, from the northern part of Africa or from Yemen. They received the same treatment. They have been their culture, their language, everything that they brought with them was valued as not as good as the coming things that came from east of Europe. So basically, I think it's something that's rooted in the Zionists and the Jewish society here in Israel.
The daunting report reveals a sharp increase in the number of immigrant families imprisoned for the purpose of deportation from Israel. And for the first time, it also aimed to detain students. Such torture of migrants is not new. In 2018, the United Nations said that migrants in Israel suffered from abuse and torture before they were ultimately deported. The UN refugee conducted research into the subject and highlighted 80 individual cases of people who risked their lives after they were relocated by Israel and then had to make hazardous journeys to Europe through Libya. The UN said that migrants suffered abuse, torture, and extortion before risking their lives once again by crossing the Mediterranean to Italy after Israel had sent them away. In April 2018, Israel reached an agreement with the United Nations to expel around 16,000 African migrants to Western countries in exchange for granting temporary residency in Israel to the same number. Shortly after, however, the deal was cancelled by the Israeli regime.
All these years, actually, since 2013, when Israel started sending asylum seekers to Rwanda and Uganda, only asylum seekers who decided to move to these countries left. No one was taken there by force. It is correct that many of them felt coerced to go there because of the heavy decrees and laws that locked them down in prison, in Cholot, all the economic decrees that took away such a large amount of their salaries and left them with no means to live. The international law brutally when it deals with both asylum seekers and migrant workers. We see in the case of migrant workers that people are detained in illegal condition, not just according to international law, but also according to the Israeli law. And regarding asylum seekers, we see that Israel do not bother to check the asylum claims, detain them, coerce them to move to other country, and limit their freedom of movement in a way that violates the Refugee Convention.
On social media, the conversation was tense. Suburb says that an Israeli court rules the city to be a white city and that schools for blacks or funding transport for black school children to attend school elsewhere are liable to alter the city's demographic balance. This could incentivize blacks to move into the city, damaging its white character. Fatima says that the crimes that are happening all over the world against the oppressed Yemenis, Palestinians, Afghans, Indians, Chinese, blacks, etc. are being planned by the United States and Israel. The international community must protest against these atrocities. Ali says the extinction of insects and reptiles is important to the United Nations.
And there are different types of immigrants in Israel. There are migrant workers and there are asylum seekers, as I said. But it's very, very difficult to naturalize in Israel if you're not coming and making aliyah, if you're not coming as a Jew from a different country and trying to live here permanently. It's nearly impossible to naturalize here, including if you're an immigrant, a non-Jewish immigrant that wants to marry or marries outside of the country a citizen. So there's a lot of bureaucracy, and the legal system is not set up to help migrant workers and refugees, and this is why they're a vulnerable community in Israel. And so, you know, even things like getting social services during a global pandemic, as I said, the deposit law was canceled, but there are lots of other issues and social benefits that other people living here, citizens mainly, are receiving that these people are not receiving because they're not really recognized.
And I'm here in order to make a change. We have a prime minister who's divisive, who is splitting the country, who is ruining our economy, and who is undermining the structure of democracy.
I'm coming here to protest for 6 months because our Prime Minister has this criminal, and he's kind of dictator. and we want him out.
Basically, Israel does not respect any international law. It doesn't respect the international law, the refugee convention, the Geneva Convention. It has never been committed to anything in the Geneva Convention regarding asylum seekers, regarding refugees. But it also does the same thing towards the Palestinians. There are no international laws, none whatsoever, that Israel respects. Even the deportation, they found a system with these third countries. I call them the revolving door, Rwanda and Uganda, which they did not even allow to say their name in courts. By the way, I went to Uganda, and we also had connections with parliament members of Uganda. That's one of the reasons that his program has failed. We collected testimonies, and we know that Israel has done everything it's in its power to either walk around these international laws or disregard them in general. I would even say that the Supreme Court of Israel itself does not respect the international law. It doesn't say so out front, but it definitely does everything in its power to override these international laws. Can public pressure create a change? No. Public pressure, if it's not, governments cannot create a change, okay? The whole BDS movement, which basically Israel is very worried by it, cannot really create change, because we're not talking about governments. We're talking about private people, NGOs, or whatever. If the only way, I think, basically, if you ask me, and this is what we have worked towards with 2018, when we were hoping that the deal with the UN would go through, Israel will never accept its small amount of asylum seekers. We're talking about a very small, we're talking about less than 30,000 asylum seekers that are even not called asylum seekers. They're called infiltrators. They're called infiltrators by the court, by the Supreme Court. No, these people will never receive fair treatment. They will never be considered human beings, basically.
The migrants that have been tortured include workers that have been working in Israel for decades. They are cheap labor and working conditions that Israeli employees do not. They do not receive any incentives or benefits. In fact, many of them do not see their paychecks in years. Israel has been allowing this to go on for decades. To many of these migrants and laborers, they are being treated as modern-day slaves. Israel has promised them savings forcefully cut from their paychecks if they leave. Israel has been wanting them to leave for years. Now, it is executing mass imprisonment of this minority group of people. It remains to be seen what actions the UN will take after the latest torture report in Israel. Here is the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. The father of Facebook Israel CEO and an active protester against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was killed after being struck by a car during an anti-Netanyahu protest at the entrance of the city of Savion. Police ruled out any intention to harm by the driver, a woman in her 20s. The Times of Israel. Hackers published sensitive client information stolen from Sherbet Insurance after the company refused on Friday to pay the approximately $1 million ransom demanded. The group responsible for the attack, Black Shadow, had said that if the requested sum of now 200 bitcoins was transferred into its account, it would not publish or sell the information. I-24 News. Amir Peretz, Israel's economy minister and head of the Labor Party, announced that he will be running for Israel's presidency in 2021. Peretz, who was the military minister during the 2006 Second Lebanon War, made the announcement in an interview with Army Radio. Israel's current president, Reuven Rivlin, is set to step down in mid-2021, with the Knesset, Israeli parliament, tasked with electing the next president. Ynet News. Two Israeli teenagers have been arrested on suspicion of sexually abusing two small children over a period of 2 years, the police said. According to the police, some of the abuses of the children, aged 4 and 7, took place inside a local synagogue. During the covert probe, the investigators gathered findings and collected evidence from several children, which helped them to uncover the affair.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.